Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. This is Nick Katman with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as consulting around manufacturing and engineering. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com, check us out, and get in touch. So today I am speaking with Brian Dentz. Thank you very much, Brian, for joining the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Okay,
It's an
excellent.
Exciting topic.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get into the topic for today, could you introduce yourself?
Yes, so my name is Brian Dentz. I have been in the medical device industry now for over 30 years, and covering everything from dental instruments to large equipment, diagnostic equipment. And I've spent a lot of time in orthopedics and spine, been around contact lenses and urological products, you name it. I've left some out here, but a lot of experience, big and small companies. I've worked for two startups, as well as three very large conglomerate corporations. Been consulting now for almost 13 years and connected with the FDA group for seven.
Yeah, well, it's an excellent partnership, and we're glad to have you on our roster to help the different clients we run into. So today's topic is going to be focused around risk management for medical device across different markets. So I want to just kind of start off at a very high level as we kind of dive into the details. How do you define risk management?
So it's a big topic. It starts right when you are developing your product, designing and developing. But it can also be used at the contract manufacturing level on just the process side. But that's usually, it starts with a lot of input from the original equipment manufacturer, the one that designed and developed the product, to give you what the features of the product are, and then determine what your risks are from a design standpoint, a usability standpoint, and a processing standpoint. It starts at a high level, and where you are looking at the hazards that can be caused by using the product, and then you start to evaluate what the resulting risks can be for each of the different elements of the use of the product or the features of the product or even the process in making it. Risk, just risk itself, is defined as the combination of the hazard and its probability of occurrence. And then we relate that to usability, design, or the process step. And I'm sure we'll get into more of those details as we progress.
Now, why is risk management important?
It is becoming almost the foundation of what the regulations are aiming for. In the past, you know, everybody knows about good manufacturing practices, quality systems within an organization. And we've all heard about CAPA and management review and non-conforming product, all the things that we've heard for decades in the industry. But that's not enough. And there's a lot of other pressures in the industry to reduce costs, to make designs better, to make them more effective, and to not create hazards. There have been a lot of situations where products have gotten to the market and caused a lot of harm. So risk management has become much more important in it's being part of the regulations. It doesn't take away the quality system, but it's being integrated with the quality systems, and it's important to provide a good, safe product that's cost effective.
So we talked about how we're going to look at risk management for medical devices across different markets. What are the markets we're going to be focusing in on today?
Well, the European Union is probably where this is the most significant and has the tightest requirements. Canada has some, they absolutely require that you have a risk management system in the process. In fact, all of the MDSAP countries will expect it, and that includes the U.S. I would say, though, that, and I'll bring up the U.S. Here we are here in the U.S., and there is not really a regulation that says you have to follow risk management. But if you are doing the MDSAP program with the FDA, you will have to do it because it's part of 13485, and that's what you would be evaluated to. Also, the nature of your product. If you have something that needs to be addressed, risk management may be the tool. And if you are using risk management, you would be expected to define what standard you're following, mm-hmm. even in the U.S.
Excellent. So across those markets that you just listed, can you highlight what some of the similarities are and also what some of the differences are?
Okay. So the basic standard everybody tries to follow is called ISO 14971. Now there's a couple of different versions. The only one that's really active today is the 2019 standard. That's the newest and the latest and the greatest. It was designed to align with the EU MDR regulation. There were some prior versions, and I'll go back to the 2007 version. That's the one that was in place for a very long time. And it allowed you to determine your risk acceptability for yourself. And you could reduce risks as far as reasonably achievable. That wasn't good enough, so they went to the 2012 version where you had to reduce risks as far as possible. And then what they meant by that was you could not consider economic factors in the reduction of the risk. So, and there was a lot of mismatch and misunderstandings about how that was really to be enforced and applied. And not to get too far into it on just this question, but that created some issues for companies because it was really just pushing products right out of the market. And all of a sudden, nothing is good enough, right? Because you can always reduce a risk further, but when you're done, you may not have a product that works. So they came up with the 2019 standard, and essentially that just meant that now you can, there's three different ways. As far as possible, as low as reasonably achievable, and as, now I'm drawing a blank on the third one. But it's, the point here is that you can define it for yourself, but it has to, in the end, you have to reduce the risk far enough that your benefit outweighs the risk and that you meet the state of the art. And you have to justify that you have to show through post-clinical data, post-production data, that you actually have reduced it and that you are meeting the need and that the benefit outweighs the risk. You have to show that with data.
If a company complies with 14971, does that mean that they also comply with EU MDR? And if not, what are the gaps?
No. You don't. And this is a painful one that I've even felt. I've implemented probably six different risk management programs to comply with 2019. And they've gone through three different notified body audits. Two of those, it went through with flying colors. There's another one that has found some issues. And I think in some cases, they are taking it too far, because when you get into identifying what the risks are, often there's, you don't know where to stop, you know, and I can talk about that later. But the difference between EU MDR and the 2019 standard is that there are 15 GSPRs, which are general safety and performance requirements, that are written right into the regulations. And those 15 different ones require you to reduce risk as far as possible, not as low as reasonably achievable. And if you're not careful, you could easily forget those or miss those, and it will be caught in an audit. Mm-hmm. Another area is in usability. There's kind of an unwritten expectation that you use usability in your risk management, but it's not really explicitly described in the standard 14971-2019. It's not really explained in there explicitly. If you're making large electromechanical equipment, you're probably employing usability because that's just what the standard is. In fact, the IEC standards for electrical equipment does require it. But when you're making lower level hand instruments, you don't think to do it, right? But the notified bodies are expecting you to employ usability in your risk management, even for those hand instruments, lower class devices.
Mm-hmm. Could you speak a little bit more about some of the similarities and differences across the different markets?
14971 is extensive, and I would say 95% of it is pretty consistent, especially if you're following the 2019 standard. Mm-hmm. If you're following that standard, you're gonna fit with everybody. Now, the U.S. has hesitated. I think COVID has been part of it. They want to, I don't think harmonize is the right word, but they want to make that a recognized standard to follow, even here in the U.S., even though there's not really a regulation that says you have to. But if you do, that is the one they expect you to follow.
Mm.
Canada, on the other hand, you could probably get away with following 2007. But I think you'd have to be careful there because it would depend on the notified body that's evaluating you too. Mm-hmm. But if you follow the 2019 standard, you're going to be pretty close in all the markets. The only thing you would have to do then, if you're going to Europe, is just make sure that you catch those 15 GSPRs and you include usability. Don't skip it just because you've got a simple device.
Mm-hmm. As I'm listening to you, it's becoming apparent that risk management has a level of subjectivity to it. So how do people determine risk acceptability?
So the standard itself gives you a ranking system. It's not something you have to follow. It's just suggested. But my suggestion is use what they've given you, because that's what everybody wants to evaluate. Some people get fancy with the lower class devices and they say, well, you know, my device is never going to kill somebody. So my highest hazard ranking of a 5, I'm not going to call that death. I'm just going to call that serious injury. So they make serious injury their 5. The problem with that approach is that you set yourself up for perceived high risks when you really don't have them. So I personally recommend that they use the standard or use the ranking system right in the standard. And if you're never going to kill somebody, then you don't have a 5 in your evaluations. Mm-hmm. You'll have 3s and 4s. But that will help show that your product is safe. The other thing you have to do is determine for your product, and that's the key here, because some products are by nature risky, and some are not as risky, right? And you may need to have more scrutiny on the higher risk devices and look at your clinical data, look at your complaint history. If it's a legacy product, go back through all your other complaint history. Look at the MAUDE database, for example, with the FDA, and look at the adverse events reported even by your competitors. And then you can see where yours fits. Are you failing at the same rate they are or not? And by the way, this brings in another element of it, which of the 2019 standard is the state of the art. People, when they hear the term state of the art, they think it's the best, right? That's state of the art technology and everybody mm-hmm. thinks that's the best. The definition here for risk management is you're within the range. You don't have to target the range. You may want to be at the higher end in the performance because you want to be the best in the market. But from the standpoint of mitigating your risks, you are comparing it with the average. If you can even, and there's ways to justify it, even if you fall below the average, maybe just say that you're within the stand, you know, two standard deviations or whatever, but you're within that range that you're competing with, and you feel that, for your product and your marketability to go any further in mitigating it would require you to take the product off the market. What good is that, right? So you have to go and look. The key here to your risk acceptability is determine for yourself what risk is unacceptable, but base it on the safety, not on the cost. Worry about the cost later. Later in the process, but definitely compare it to the safety and prove that the benefit of the product outweighs the risk.
How important is usability?
So it is important, and I learned this the hard way because I've done a lot of work with companies, dental companies, orthopedic companies that have little hand instruments, and the risk is low. You know, you're probably just not going to kill somebody with one of these devices. I'm going to say it's impossible. I had a notified body auditor tell me you didn't consider this risk of a spark in a room with noxious fumes and it was going to blow up and wipe out the facility and kill five people, right? That's where I think sometimes they go too far. I'm sorry, what was the question?
How important is usability?
Yeah, so in applying that, even though they're the simple devices, you do have to consider usability. They are expecting you to have a usability engineering file that can be integrated with your design history file. It can be integrated with your risk management file. It does not have to be a separate set of documents, but you have to clearly identify what the usability specification is. And by the way, this comes from the BSEN 62366 standard and use the current one. I think it's -1 2015. So usability spec, and then you, at that point, especially if it's a legacy product, you can start to integrate it with the data you already have. But I don't want to get into the usability standard itself, but there's a whole process for usability engineering on new products. But when you're done, you will find the hazards that align with usability, and it focuses on the usability interface. Well, going back to the simple devices, for example, you know, on a big device, on something that's electromechanical, you'll have a graphic interface where the user is actually punching buttons and reading a screen, and it's got warnings and feedback. That's usability. That's where usability normally comes into play. But with these little hand instruments, your user interface is literally what you're touching. Where's your handle? It's also your labeling. When you open the package, what did the label tell you? What it was, what size, your instructions for use, that is a user interface. And they want you to consider everything in that user interface and how it relates to the hazards of using the product.
I want to jump into FMEA, but before we do that, is there anything that you want to touch on before we transition?
Yes. So the risk management process starts there's a flow chart in the standard that shows you all the steps, and I won't go through every single step, but the basic approach is you determine what your user needs are, you know, in design controls. You come up with product requirements, design requirements, and then those features of the product, and going back to usability, as we just spoke, the usability hazards, you evaluate how that product would be used in its procedure. And there's a guidance in one of the annexes of 14971, 2019, that will, it gives you like 35 or 37 different questions you ask yourself. And some of them don't apply, but answer those, answer any from the usability. I would look at the usability standard and make sure there's nothing you're missing. And look at your own requirements and think about how it's going to be used, and make sure you've hit all the ways the product are going to be used. What are the hazards? And a hazard is something that can cause serious injury or death. That's the top-down approach, and that's the first step you take. Then, when you've identified those, now you go to your actual design and you evaluate every feature of the part or product for what about that feature could lead to that hazard. And you do this line by line by line by line, and the spreadsheets that you usually create have, you know, 12 or 15 columns in them, all about what's the hazard, what can cause the hazard, or what the failure is and what can cause it, what's the frequency, how do you
mitigate it?
Getting ahead of myself. Well, now I'm getting ahead of myself on that, because there's an element that will come into the process FMEA. So you have design FMEAs, you have usability FMEAs, and then you have process FMEAs. And design FMEAs and usability FMEAs are only going to look at risk from the standpoint of the hazard in relation to its probability of occurrence. And you evaluate all these things, and then you come up with a risk priority number, and it's multiplying your rankings of 1 to 5 in each of the categories. And if you've got 5 and 5, then, you know, you get 25. That's the highest hazard you can have with the 1 to 5 ranking. And you have to mitigate those risks by either changing the design or changing the way you use it. You have to reevaluate what you're going to do to help mitigate those risks to get them down to an acceptable level based on what you did in your, and you have to do a plan before you do all this, where you predetermine what your risk acceptability is. Then when you finally got that locked down and you figure out how you're going to make it, then you apply a process FMEA. And that's where you go through and look at every step in the manufacturing process. What can cause a failure in the device when it's used that was caused by a manufacturing process? Now, this is where it can be different, because there's one notified body out there that insists, because the standard does not talk about detectability. This is another area you can rank and measure and determine how it's another way to mitigate your risk. And there's one notified body that does not allow it because it's not discussed in the standard. But the other two that I've been involved with do actually allow it. And it is a great, in my opinion, it's a great tool, unless you're being told you can't use it. It's a great tool because you've found a way in your process to detect the problem. The reason you can't use detection in the design FMEA or the user FMEA is because when the failure happens, it's already too late. So it's not really detected. But if you're in the manufacturing process and you haven't released the product for distribution, you may detect the failure in the process that could cause the issue with the device. So that is the detectability you can use.
Yeah.
And you go through two rounds of that to try and get your risk low enough that it meets your risk acceptability.
Mm-hmm. I want to kind of go back slightly. What does FMEA stand for and what is it?
Failure modes and effects analysis. And there's that's a whole science in itself. For years, that was risk management. And even when ISO 14971 2007 was the standard, they talked about all the other parts of the process, the hazard analysis and benefit risk. They called it risk benefit back then and all that. But a lot of people just did FMEAs. That's all they did. And they called that their risk management file. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work anymore. You have to have a full risk management file with your plan, your hazard assessment, your FMEAs. And there's other ways to do it. There's also fault tree analysis. There's also FMEKA, which is failure modes and criticality analysis. Food industry uses that a lot. They also use HADCAP. I'm personally more familiar with FMEA, although I have done a little bit with both FMEKA and HADCAP. Mm-hmm. I forgot what HADCAP stands for.
Fair it's another enough.
Food, very food related thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So when it comes to risk management and FMEA, what is you obviously explained that they're two different things, but what would you say is the big takeaway as it pertains to risk management and FMEA?
A lot of people think they can get somebody in a room, they can get a group of people. It's a team effort. You're going to have people from engineering. When I say engineering, I mean, actually, I'll further define it. You want people from product development. You want people from manufacturing. You want people from quality. And you even want people from marketing. Mm-hmm. Even though they're not always the technical people, they do know how it's used, and they may even know from their salespeople how often something has happened with legacy products that are similar, and they can give you feedback on what the rate of occurrence might be. Mm. I'd say the biggest takeaway there with in doing the FMEAs is I think a lot of people think they can just get this group of people together and lock them in a room and don't come out until it's done, right? Mm. But that's not possible. You have to go through one round and then say, this is what it is. And then you go out and actually make changes either to the design of the product or to the process for manufacturing it and test it again. And then you come back and revisit whichever FMEA you're working on to evaluate whether you've reduced that risk or not. Mm-hmm. And you have to verify it. So when you do these mitigations, you have to actually try it and test it and prove that your actions actually did reduce the occurrence. That reminds me of one other thing. I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's highly unlikely when you're mitigating risk that you can eliminate or reduce a hazard. And that's the severity of the risk, because the hazard is the hazard, right? The only way to really reduce the risk is to affect its probability of occurrence. So you're trying to reduce as far as possible how often this is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And And maybe to be helpful in understanding what that means in a 1 to 5 ranking. So severity, a 1 is a minor nuisance that you barely identify. And it is subjective. You used the word subjective earlier in this discussion. It is subjective. But a 1 would be, say, a minor, hard to even identify that a problem has happened. A 2 would be something that fails, and maybe you can't use the device anymore, but it didn't hurt anybody, you know, and maybe it comes in a pack of 5 and you got another one and you just use it, or I don't know. It could be, there's a lot of reasons for a 2 beyond that, but it's essentially that something went wrong and you have to either do something or you can't use it, but it's not causing an actual injury or death. A 3 is typically that it's causing an injury, some form of temporary injury that can be reversed or will heal on its own. A 4 means that you've got a serious injury that requires medical intervention to correct, which when you go back to in the US, the medical device reporting regulation, that's the requirement, right? Mm-hmm. If it required medical intervention to repair an injury or there was a death, then it's a medical device report. So the medical device reports are the 4s, and then the 5s, of course, are death with the severity. I have actually had one on a very simple hand instrument where we were forced to use a 5. And it's so rare that it's never even happened in 60 years. This device is at least 60 years old, but we had to consider it. That's another case of showing how severity can't be reduced in some cases, but the probability can. Probabilities, very quickly. The 1 is, it's say 1 in 10 or 1 in 100. I forgot the actual scale. 2 is 1 in 1,000. I think it's 1 in 100 is 1. 2 is 1 in it occurs once in every 1,000. 3 would be once in every 10,000. 4 would be 1 in every 100,000. And 5 would be 1 in a million. So, and that's a logarithmic scale. You know, if you plotted it out, it's not a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough to go from a 5 to a 4. But once you do, you've made a huge improvement. And likewise down the scale.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, this was super useful. Before we close, what would you say the listeners should take away? What's the 1 or 2 big points that you want to drive home?
If you have to comply with risk management, read ISO 14971. Another part of that I have not mentioned yet is ISO TR 24971, which is the guidance document on how to comply with 14971. And this is the 2019 standard. You can't comply with 14971 if you don't understand the TR 24971. And that one's a 2020 version. It came out the year after the actual standard. Read it. Understand it. If you're going to Europe, I would suggest you really read the EU MDR regulation very closely and look at the GSPRs, maybe do a search on, this is how I did it, search the EU MDR regulation on as far as possible, because that's the caveat. You have to reduce your risk as far as possible with these 15 different GSPRs. Find out which ones those are. Do they apply to your product? Some of them won't. You know, some of them deal with radiation. If you got a product that's not radiation, then it won't apply. But make sure you understand what those are. And that's the key. I think that's the key. Just knowing EU MDR, the differences. If you're not going to go to Europe, just focus on following the 2019 standard and understanding its guidance document.
Yep. Excellent. Well, like I said, this was super helpful. I really appreciate the time, Brian. And to everybody listening, as always, if you find conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at theftagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to connect about project or resource needs, head over to theftagroup.com and get in touch, or feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. So thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.